I said at the beginning of the first lecture that that entry to the Romanian, the sort of classic Romanian folklore tale, once upon a time when vampires were as common as leaves, could equally apply to now, and I think now it really does. So we saw at the end of the 20th century a start of the proliferation of vampires, following Anne Rice, following Buffy. The vampire becomes very common in popular culture, particularly popular media. Part of this, I suspect, is because of the development of technology and the way in which it becomes, as the 20th century continues, easier and easier to represent vampires in film because of developments in special effects, and particularly CGI. Computer-generated special effects have revolutionized the way that film is made and have made all sorts of things possible that they never used to be. So we are now able not only to show the sort of blood and gore and entrails flying, which some of these modern films like to do, but to show vampires flying, to show them transforming into animals or into mist. It's now much easier and much cheaper to produce. Just wandering in and out. Can you guys hear? To produce films that have extravagant special effects that very much do pull you in and convince you about the reality of what's going on. And this is why you end up with films like, for example, 2004's Van Helsing, which is this giant, loud special effects extravaganza which has absolutely no redeeming narrative or artistic merit whatsoever, with the possible exception of Hugh Jackman, who's always watchable. Avoid it at all costs. It's a terrible film. It's special effects gone wild. There's no substance to them whatsoever. And it's also interesting to watch how it works out in Buffy. Buffy vampires don't transform into mist and they don't transform into animals, because in the 90s when the show started, Fox didn't have the budget and we didn't have the special effects. Around about season 5, they have an episode with Dracula himself turning up in it, in which Dracula does fly and does transform to mist, because by that stage the show is popular enough that they can pour more money into it, and simultaneously the technology is much easier and much cheaper. So it's been an inevitable rise, not just because of cultural awareness of the vampire, but because of technology itself. So a lot of the vampire films that are popular around the end of the 20th century feature the vampire as the monster. They're slasher films in a lot of ways. There's lots of gore. The vampire is occupying the same narrative space as the werewolf, the alien, the zombie. The excitement of watching is in the threat, the danger, the resolution of the problem and the overcoming of the monster. So it's very much this development of the tradition set up by the Hammer and the Universal monster films. So late 20th century movies, Near Dark, Dracula 2000, John Carpenter's Vampires, the Blade Trilogy, the Underworld series, Van Helsing, and don't go there, as I said, Fright Night. These are action horror films. There is a lot of gore. And the violence of it does, I think, some quite perverse things to the parallel sexual romantic element that still tends to prevail, even though there's this increased focus on violence and terror. But you're also in the sort of Anne Rice tradition and in the Bela Lugosi tradition, you're seeing a parallel development alongside the slasher vampire of the vampire as effectively a romance hero. And this is where Edward in Twilight is coming from. The desirable, ideal, glittery kind of figure who is at the other end of the vampire spectrum to the violence, who almost in a sense denies the violence. The most interesting contemporary texts mix the two, as Buffy does, cause them to interrogate each other. The romantic aspect interrogates the violence and the identity of the monster. The violence interrogates the assumptions about the romantic appeal. So it can be complicated. Most of these films are not. And the question, of course, is, as the 20th century gives way to the 21st century, we've seen an enormous rise in the element of romance in the depiction of a vampire. And the question is why? And I don't think there's a simple answer. I think part of this is because of the growth of romance as a category across the 20th century in both popular literature and in film and TV. Romance is a very easily recognizable Hollywood trope, for example. Media representations of romance are very high-selling kinds of constellations of images we use sexuality and romance to sell an awful lot, becomes almost inevitable given media culture that this will start to move into this particular symbol. I also have a slightly despairing tendency to see some of it as almost backlash against feminism, you know, coming out of the 70s and the militant feminism and moving into what is supposed to be post-feminism, but in fact is giving us a giving society all sorts of ways to deny the gains that have been made by feminist resistance, to basically, oh gosh, yes, romance is okay, being, you know, feminine, being passive, all these things are okay, in a way that very directly militates against a lot of the things that classical feminist discourse insists are not, in fact, okay. So in this sense, the vampire comes to function in the romantic context as the ultimate kind of bad boy suitor, the appeal of the dangerous, the person you are not supposed to be attracted to, but are, simply because they are dangerous. And this plays into another very common trope in media, which is that tendency in popular narratives, and you see this a lot on television, to demand that romance must somehow be complicated or dramatic. You very seldom see untroubled, happy, content romantic relationships in a television or film context. The narrative drive tends to demand that we complicate this. A vampire will complicate your romance beautifully. Take it from me. It really will. So the vampire, it has become inextricable from modern media. And to me, one of the most interesting ways in which it has become inextricable from modern media is in the way that the visual representation of the vampire has changed over time. So I'm going to start this right at the beginning. Okay, that is Count Orlok from Murnau's 1922 film. That is the Two Little Incisors, the goblinoid vampire. Okay, that's Bela Lugosi. He's compelling, certainly. He's much less monstrous. He's still not a classically good-looking man. That's Christopher Lee. Now moving into the 50s, classic Hammer vampire. That's Tom Cruise doing the vampire Lestat. That's Brad Pitt doing Louis, both from Interview with a Vampire, the Neil Jordan film of. That's Antonio Banderas, who, as the third in the giant sex symbol stars, was also cast in Interview with a Vampire. We move on to Buffy, late 90s, Angel, one of her vampire lovers, Spike, her other vampire lover. Okay, we now move further into the early 21st century with Edward from Twilight. Almost at the same time as Edward, we're seeing another major vampire television text, which is True Blood. That's Bill from True Blood. That is Eric from True Blood. Okay, and the most contemporary example that I'm going to use is The Vampire Diaries, which gives us Stefan and Damon. Are you recognizing a trend here? Okay, so I've chosen specifically male vampires because they are more common. And this is a chronological listing, as I say. It's gone right from 1922 all the way through to the contemporary. Vampire Diaries are still running at the moment. You can see the trend in various ways. The types of actors chosen, from Orlok all the way through to Damon, they become steadily more good-looking. Okay? In age, they become steadily younger. The two True Blood guys, Bill and Eric, are actually a little bit older and are a bit of a welcome break, but these two are like early 20s, they're really young guys. But most interestingly, the way that they are represented, I have chosen all of these images from promotional images for the various films or television series. So as time goes on, the poses become less and less recognizable as a vampire, and more they are posed simply as a good-looking male actor. I mean, the really completely ridiculous example is Eric. That's actually a pose from within True Blood. The vampires in True Blood to get together and make a calendar. He's Mr. January, as far as I remember. That's his calendar pose. But it's a very common promotional photo for True Blood. So, I mean, Damon is just ridiculous. I mean, clearly they just chose him on looks. It's absurd. So you can see how More and more, the vampire is becoming not a monster looming at you out of the screen as a threatening icon, but it's becoming an extremely good-looking male who is sexualized. A lot of those poses are smoldering. They are looking directly out at you in that directly challenging, sexualized sort of fashion. They are displayed for the camera as an object rather than as a vampire character. And it's also particularly interesting. It's one very strong arena of culture in which you can see how gender roles have shifted, and that this is objectification of male figures, which you most often see applied to female figures. And this again speaks to the enormous female predominance in the fandoms who follow these vampire texts. It goes right back to Gothic literature. A lot of these vampire texts have a strongly female viewership. So what this to me does is to speak to the way in which the symbol of the vampire in media has become heavily invested, particularly in the star system, in the idea of celebrity and the objectification of these beautiful actors. And here you have an absolutely characteristic late 20th, early 21st century kind of re-examination of the vampire in terms of the vampire's immortality, where immortality to the Victorians was troubling and unchristian and unnatural and wrong. In our contemporary society, immortality is the dream, it's the ideal. Not just immortality, but eternal youth and beauty is what our media sells to us, day in and day out. You buy these products, you wear these clothes, you will become young and beautiful forever. So the vampire becomes an incredibly powerful symbol for reifying and externalizing what is already inherent in the culture in which we live. So it becomes much less about immortality as an association with the past being primitive, being non-progressive, and becomes immortality as looking forward into the future with the static, unchanging ideal of youth and beauty. And this is moving right through Anne Rice and beyond to be about wealth and hedonism, that self-indulgence, that idea of the focus on the vampire's interiority and individualism, linking very, very inevitably to the way that our media sells our individuality, and that individuality in terms which allow us to construct ourselves as young and beautiful. And this resonates very powerfully with the erotic underpinnings of the vampire image. You know, there's that whole sexual charge to the vampire image anyway. As soon as you move it into the realm of contemporary media with the idea of youth and beauty, the whole lot mixes together and feeds off each other in a very powerful way. It also, I think, speaks to our contemporary celebrity culture. Vampires are the ultimate celebrity, if you like. Like Hollywood stars, they are superhuman. They are supernatural creatures. They are not as we are. They are more beautiful, more powerful. They are not bound by the rules which govern the rest of us. So that progression in that series of images that I showed, I think, is enormously important. I think it's enormously important in terms of how it points to the new things that we are discovering in the vampire image. part of this sexualization is about youth and beauty and what we expect from it in contemporary society. Part of it is also, I think, about what modern media does to romance. Now, one of the, if you look at the 19th century vampire movie, the texts, as arising out of partially Gothic literature at the end of the 18th, early 19th century, a lot of contemporary media versions of vampires, film and television vampires, are actually arising in a very similar way out of the contemporary paranormal romance genre. This is a subset both of romance and of horror. It's this kind of interesting miscegenated dual category. It's an enormously popular category. It has a lot of authors who are making an awful amount of money, lots of publishers who are making an awful lot of money on it. And it has a very strong crossover with the new young adult literature category, which is also very high-selling. So what it is a crossover between two very high-selling popular literary formulae, the horror story and the romance story, which generally, interestingly, doesn't have quite the same readership. And the new hybrid category has a very powerfully female readership. Its horror elements tend to allow for the proliferation of the vampire as a symbol in tandem with pretty much anything else you can think of that is magical or supernatural. Witches, wizards, werewolves, shapeshifters, fairy, demons, succubi, ghosts, telepaths, even zombies recently. How you romanticize a zombie is beyond me, but they try. So you can see from the covers that I've got here, which is a fairly random selection. Laurel K. Hamilton, Kelly Armstrong, Sherilyn Kenyon, three of the big names in the contemporary paranormal romance genre. They're writing multiple novels a year. They're making huge amounts of money. They're selling vast amounts. But look at the way that this is simultaneously focusing on the sexual and the supernatural. Okay? And a lot of these series that these women write feature a female heroine who is a vampire hunter, or a vampire, or a werewolf, or a telepath, or a something. And who, if she is normal, is hunting down or looking after or somewhere involved with the world of these creatures, and who often has lovers who are vampires or werewolves or whatever, one of the many. So here, naked female body, which you probably can't see in the background because I couldn't find a high res of this, that's a wolf howling at the moon. There are almost certainly werewolves all over this particular novel. That's got some sort of magical occultic thing going. It's a pentagram, it's a gargoyle behind, quite possibly a gargoyle coming to life at some point. The pose suggests that, in fact, she has a gargoyle lover, which is just weird. And then Dream Warrior, more of the same in that series of images that we're starting to objectify, not just the naked female body that you've got in the Hamilton, but the good-looking male on the cover as well. Once again, we are appealing to a female demographic who is wanting to both identify with the beautiful body and be drawn to the attractive male, presumably. So paranormal romance is overlaps with an existing fantasy category which is known as urban fantasy. Contemporary settings, usually, some of them are period pieces, but more commonly they're contemporary. Usually urban, so it's set in the cities, and usually presupposes the coexistence of the sort of shadowy underworld of supernatural creatures with a normal city life going on top. And the characters move between the two. So it's a very powerful, very energized setting. It has vast amounts of freedom and possibility. As I said, they're often female protagonists. There's often a detective format, an investigation of some sort. Often the female protagonist has a supernatural power. She always has a difficult and earth-shattering romance with another supernatural being of some sort. and this is a new bandwagon. You're also seeing it proliferate out at the moment into those rather terrible rewrites of historical or literary classics with supernatural creatures infused into the mix. So Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, the movie just came out. It was a very successful book. Jane Austen with zombies, etc., etc. So this idea of the real world or a classic literary world or a classic historical world being infused with all of these exciting new supernatural symbols, they tend to be quite unthinking and quite formulaic. A lot of these novels accept their symbols wholesale. The more interesting treatments of vampires as a symbol in literary genres are occurring much more firmly into the science fiction fantasy mainstream and in the young adult novel. So you're seeing things like, for example, Kim Newman's Anno Dracula series, which presupposes that Van Helsing and his crew failed. Dracula did, in fact, take over Victorian London. It has this entire alternative universe of Victorian London with vampires and other supernatural creatures with a political interest. What would happen if you put this new power block into the world? Young adult series, Scott Westerfield's Parasite Positive, really, really good young adult series that treats vampirism as a parasitic organism. Does a scientific, slightly post-apocalyptic investigation of it. Very intelligent novel. Very different to what this sort of thing is doing, which is to give you relatively unadulterated. The first Laurel K. Hamilton book is called Guilty Pleasures. The first one that features Anita Blake, Vampire Hunt. And that's what they are. You know, they're not trying to be anything literary. They're trying to give you that thrill, both of violence and of sexuality, in one lovely package with a, you know, giant pink bow on it. So in the 21st century, what we're seeing is vampires as very much part of a much larger landscape of the supernatural, with a strong tendency, as I say, towards spicing up standard romance tropes with supernatural elements. It's plugging into media awareness of celebrity culture, and it's all becoming this giant media kind of landscape in which everything is interconnected, which everything speaks to everything else, which is probably why we are dealing with this stupid success of Twilight. Okay, so Twilight, the books were published 2005 to 2008, the films were 2008 to 2012. Okay, these have been the vampire success story of our age. I mean, we thought Anne Rice in the 20th century was doing well. She's made to look ridiculous by what Stephanie Meyer has achieved, just in terms of popularity, number of sales, size of the checks that she's getting from the films, etc., etc., etc. It is not exaggerating to talk about Twilight as a fever. It has been. It's swept the landscape. It's profited a lot, I think, from the internet, from the way in which media culture is very much about sharing information in instantaneous ways and informing communities in instantaneous ways, which reinforces identification with these texts. But the novels themselves very much foreshadow earlier things that are done with vampires in this context. They're teen romances. They're very similar to what Buffy does. They actually shadow in an interesting way an earlier series by L.J. Smith called The Vampire Diaries, which is now made into the very popular TV series. L.J. Smith was writing initially in the 90s, and her novels vanished without a trace. Then Stephanie Meyer comes along with Twilight, makes gazillions on it, makes movies out of it. They resurrected the L.J. Smith ones and republished them with fancy covers. And they made into a TV series. In a sense, she's now riding that wave of Twilight success, even though she did it first. She's almost seen as an imitator of Twilight. It's a bit ridiculous. Okay, so like Buffy, like The Vampire Diaries, Meyer's novels are teen-focused. They feature a high school girl negotiating love and other teen challenges. Bella Swan, quite the most irritating heroine in number of years. She goes to a new school in a tiny little town of Forks, Washington. She's immediately drawn to Edward Cullen, who is the good-looking son of the mysterious, wealthy, and glamorous Cullen family. Edward saves her life. I mean, if Meyer can do anything, it is with pinpoint accuracy to hit the cliches, blam, 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 one after the other. Edward saves her life. He's obviously a vampire, as are his adopted parents and siblings. He is equally drawn to her. So she's coming to the whole vampire charm thing. He's mysterious, he's glamorous. He has a strange superhuman strength. He saves her from being crushed by a rolling away car or something like that. But they also, this whole series revolves around this fatedness of their attraction. To him, her scent is irresistible. Okay, so it picks up on the vampire's superhuman abilities. They have a hypersensitive sense of smell. But it becomes a way of reinforcing in symbolic supernatural language the kind of thing at the heart of your standard Mills and Boone Harlequin romance, a fated attraction. Again, cliche of the romance genre. So after various not very complicated separations, misunderstandings, disagreements, digressions into romances with werewolves, etc., Edward and Bella marry. Bella is changed into a vampire by Edward in time to save her life while she gives birth to their vampire child. Okay, so it's an exceptionally perverse, in a sense, mirror of the standard romance plot. Boy meets girl, there are obstacles, they get together, they marry, they have children. It's a deeply, deeply traditional romance plot in a lot of ways. It is both difficult and rather worrying to contemplate how absurdly popular this series is. It is very poorly written. It is glacially paced. Its representation of characters and relationships is simplistic to the point of being puerile. It is an absolutely uncritical use of the vampire symbol. But it has this enormous following. It has touched a cultural chord. It has put its finger in pretty much the same way that Stoker did with Dracula. It has managed, through its rather clumsy popular format, to somehow encapsulate and speak directly to issues and angsts of our time. In particular, it's speaking to a very female experience of adolescence and sexuality. So the vampire encoding as sexy, dangerous, powerful, reproduces in this extreme form the particular kind of fascinated fear of sexuality, in particular male sexuality, which an inexperienced teenage girl may feel. That idea of being attracted to an experienced lover from a point of inexperience. And that's very, very implicated in the vampire symbol right from the word go. The vampire as powerful, older, holding all that sexual power, and the vampire's victim as female, passive, younger. So that power differential is central to the whole thing. And the other interesting thing you're getting with Edward very strongly, and you also get with Buffy, is that paradoxically, while male sexual power is threatening and terrifying and fascinating and glamorous and all the rest of it, it also holds out the hope of protection. Because our culture emphasizes male power so much, something that a strong male can do if you are a teenage girl going through all the usual kind of angsts and torments of that particularly difficult time, a strong male figure is a potential protector. He can save you from all sorts of things, as Edward does, Bella, frequently, over and over again. And interestingly, in Twilight, this power and protectiveness are not simply in physical strength, immortality, superhuman speed, etc., etc., also in wealth. Like Anne Rice before her, Maya has something of a fetish for money, pure and simple, for possessions, for material wealth. So the Cullens are very much in a different class to the rest of the town. They have this giant palatial mansion. They're very wealthy, they're cultured, they have this luxury lifestyle that features designer clothing and fast cars and everything that is of expense and luxury, and further sets them apart from the town and further emphasizes both their power and their appeal. You see in Twilight the thing that Joss Whedon does much more intelligently and much more multivalently in Buffy, which is the idea of struggling with the idea of vampire nature and what it actually entails, which at base is preying on other humans. Now, this is a moral dilemma, obviously. Is it legitimate to do that? In quite a lot of vampire stories, the act of preying, the biting and the drinking blood, kills the victim. In some of the more modern ones, it doesn't. You can kind of string it out so that you take blood from someone without actually killing them. If you do it often enough, sooner or later, you're going to turn into a vampire. But it sort of seesaws. It plays with the spectrum of immorality. Is it okay if you absolutely have to do it in order to live? Is it okay to drink the blood of another human being? Twilight does not really choose to engage with this in any sort of complicated way. What it effectively does is to make Edward, etc., or his friends, his family, into good vampires, into effectively vegetarian vampires, in that they only drink the blood of animals. They do not drink the blood of humans, and they are set up against other bad vampires who do drink the blood of humans and are therefore evil and wicked and bad and presumably you should not marry and have babies with. So it denies in a very powerful way, in a similar way to what Anne Rice was doing already and which Joss Whedon was refusing to do, it denies the aspect of the vampire which is monstrous, which has the potential for evil. In place of that, it says, no, it's no problem. Edward just denies that side of him. He's a good guy, really. And in place of that, it ups the appeal. So rather than being destroyed by sunlight, which is one of the great indicators of unnaturalness and perversity, vampires in the Twilight world simply glitter in sunlight. They have this kind of stone quality to their skin. So rather than this creature of the night, which is associated with evil and which is destroyed by the clean light of the sun, instead you have an absolute literalization of the vampire as a beautiful, valuable object of desire. It also, interestingly to me, this glittery skin underlies the idea of artificiality in representation. It links the vampire much more strongly to the whole idea of media culture and media representation. It replicates the artificial gloss of a magazine page or an image on a screen. That element of hardness is both ultimately phallic and the hardness of an object rather than a person. What it reminds me of most, actually, is the imagery in Petrarchan love sonnets, where you're always comparing women to jewels, where they're beautiful and valuable and all about wealth, but they're also about objects to be possessed. So the vampire, rather than this darkness, night, crumbling in sunlight thing, becomes self-consciously and deliberately the glittering, romanticized, wealth-linked object of desire. And something not just to be desired, but to be possessed. Bella's sole motivation, Bella is the most revoltingly passive child on the face of the planet. Bella's sole motivation of any sort during the entirety of the four books is to get together with Edward, marry him, and become a vampire. She has no other interests, no other life goals, no other plans whatsoever. That is it for her. And it underlines the idea of vampire as object to be possessed. She wants to possess him. So the story is couched very much in this Mills and Boone mode of fated lovers, an attraction that is so powerful it overcomes all things. It was clearly meant by fate. The supernatural overlay of the vampiric attraction, her scent just happens to spark off Edward's desire, is a validation of a very old narrative trope, but it also insists in an interesting way that the vampire interaction doesn't just equal sex, which it always has equals. It also equals love, and love in an extremely obsessive sense. So it's adding whole new layers of resonance to that push-pull of that fatal vampire attract. It is, needless to say, if you've not picked this up from everything I've said so far, extremely problematical in gender and feminist terms. If you look at the situation of the story, Bella meets Edward when she is 17 years old. Other than the minor digressions with the werewolf, who is never the right guy for her, clearly, Edward is her only romantic experience. He's the one she's fated to be with forever. She marries him and takes the irreversible and life-changing decision to become a vampire when she is 18. Okay, so the dangers of an unrealistic, idealized, beautifully shaped love story become vastly and exponentially increased when you add to them the overlay and the re-empowerment and re-infusion with meaning of that whole supernatural vampire thing. In a sense, it reinforces it. The degree to which Bella is entrapped within this narrative is quite terrifying. It's also interesting that despite the fact that this is what she wants, all she wants is to marry Edward, this series is, despite its absolute romance focus, still surprisingly free of actual sexuality. I'm in the habit of describing Twilight to my students as Mormon abstinence porn. There is a very strong abstinence message in this series, and Stephanie Meyer is a Mormon. And Mormon religion has very, very powerfully encoded denials of premarital sex of any sort. The problem with Edward's attraction to her is that it is so strong he cannot control it. He barely dares touch her because he is afraid that he will lose control and hurt her. So he doesn't bite her until actually forced to it by the fact that the vampire child she's bearing is killing her, and making her into the vampire is the only way she's going to survive childbirth. During the course of the four novels, he hardly kisses her, he barely touches her. In terms of your average teen sort of novel, the number of make-out scenes is worryingly low. So there's none of the usual use of the bite to stand in for sexual interaction, because both real and symbolic sex acts are prohibited by the way the narrative is set up. So the balance between the sort of horror blood elements and the seduction desire elements has both swung right over into the romanticized, and it's used the symbolic element of the vampire as a way of effectively sending the message that to the young female readership that sex is wrong, that you should not have it. That you should not have sex in the same way, because it will destroy you in the same way that a vampire bite will destroy you. So therefore you must absolutely resist it. It worries me profoundly because I think it's a very unhealthy message about sexuality for a start. Sex, you should not have it, don't think about it, go away. Has not ever stopped young people from having sex, and it certainly doesn't educate them about how to have it safely. But the mold in which this is cast is actually a throwback. It's actually Victorian. The kind of inherent elements that you're getting in the way this is set up. Not only that sex before marriage is absolutely wrong, but the idea that male desire cannot be contained and that somehow there is a female responsibility for not arousing that desire. Because aroused male desire has the potential to be completely physically destructive. It inculcates a fear of sexuality. It uses the vampire symbol not to talk about ways of negotiating the simultaneous attraction and danger of sexuality. It uses it to deny the validity of sexuality, other than in that very specific context of in marriage. And it also fascinates me that I talked in earlier lectures about the elements of gender slippage in the vampire as a symbol. What I use the Freudian term polymorphous perversity, the idea that its gender identity and sexual identity shifts between different poles. It's never set. She has recast this symbol so firmly in heteronormative terms in this novel. It locks it in. She's absolutely denying the possibility of the vampire as a potentially subversive disruption to heteronormative imagery or ideas. And it's a very, very conventional, very reactionary message that I for one, find very worrying. She's bent the symbol to her own ends. She bent the symbol to her own ends in a way that I think speaks very powerfully to not just to young girls, but to women who remember what being young girls is like, but in ways that is validating, I think, the wrong elements of that experience or that memory. So it's fortunate that in addition to Twilight, we have True Blood. True Blood is a vampire TV series that was started in 2008. It's still running at the moment. It's based on a series of novels by Charlene Harris that features Sookie Stackhouse, who is a telepathic waitress in a small town in Louisiana. It's an absolutely fascinating world. Well, A, it's the antidote to Twilight. True Blood is about sex, I mean, purely and simply. What the series is interested in is vampires and sex and how vampires are all about sex. It's also quite some interesting world building. It presupposes a world in which vampires are out, if you like, that they have revealed their existence to the world. They have been enabled to do this to be accepted as a part of society by the fact that the Japanese have invented True Blood, which is an artificial human blood substitute, which means vampires can now drink it without actually having to kill people. Okay, so it doesn't particularly stop them from biting people, but it moves the whole biting thing and blood drinking thing right out of the realm of I am a vampire, I must eat you to survive, and into the realm of I am a vampire and I am eating you because it is sexy, which it really is. I mean, both the books and the series go way over the top in the sort of absolute literalness with which they deal with the vampire act as the sexual one. So the story is a love triangle. Sookie is drifting between Bill and the two I showed you earlier. Bill, who's a 200-year-old American colonial, and Eric, who's a vampire, a Viking, and much older. It's an interesting rationalization of the idea of human vampire love story, because Sookie is a telepath. At the beginning of the series, she's never actually had sex with anyone because she can hear everything that anybody is thinking, and that's just not sexy in most contexts. And the thing about vampires is she can't hear them. So it beautifully rationalizes the idea of her and vampires as a logical pairing, because the supernatural element in Vampires overcomes that supernatural drawback in herself. So she has this kind of relief of not actually being able to hear her partner. This is obviously a very much more adult text than Twilight ever was, both in its insistence on the eroticism of the vampire symbol and in its use of violence. As I said, it has absolutely no track with subtexts. The erotic element in True Blood is text. I'm proud of it. So the assumptions are that because vampires are out in the open, everything that we think about vampires in terms of our desire for them is also out in the open. So vampires are sexy is taken for granted. Normal humans want both the symbol, the bite, and they want the actual sex. So it doubles, if you like, the traditional way in which the symbol stands for the sexual act. Actually, the two are happening at once together here. This is being made possible by the adult coding and by the far, far greater license we have for talking about sexuality in this day and age. So True Blood is the series that has brought us the immortal phrase, fang bangers, which are usually women, but not always, humans who are totally fascinated by vampires and want to have sex around with them and will hang around with them, allowing themselves to be bitten a little bit in return for the sex, which is presumably mind-numbingly good. And obviously, as the earlier slideshow showed, the casting of these two very, very good-looking actors in the two main roles has a lot to do with the appeal of the series, particularly Alexander Skarsgård, the Eric guy. You wander around on the internet, there are fan pages and fan pages and fan pages, most of them with him shirtless. So it plays in a sense that fetishization of the actor plays into the narrative's perfectly upfront representation of vampires within the text as desirable celebrities. And of course the celebrities who play them become even more desirable outside the text. It's a very bloody series. It shows not just explicit sex, but quite often explicitly sadomasochistic sex as a sadomasochistic act. Biting is an erotic element in sex. It equally allows for really nasty vampire violence, torn out throats. Vampire bodies, when you kill them, decompose into this kind of slurry of blood and True Blood. They're revolting. So it's much more interesting than Twilight because it doesn't have that neutered element of denying the sexuality. It goes right to the other end. It wallows in it, more or less. It's very interested in exploring the actual tensions inherent in the symbol between sexuality and violence. And like Buffy, Sookie's love life never goes smoothly. The series, very much like Joss Whedon's series, is able to say, okay, if you are going to be attracted to these violent types, bad stuff is probably going to be happening a lot, and you're not really going to be happy for a lot of it. And that really does happen. But it's also, like Buffy, there's a very interesting political and social element to the world building in this series. The exploration of what it would actually mean to have vampires living openly in society. And I think it's no accident that she has set it in Louisiana, which has quite interesting socioeconomic things going on in terms of poverty and different classes and all the rest of it. So vampires are used as a symbol in the series, more powerfully in the books than in the film, the TV version, but still very powerfully, to explore racism, discrimination, social justice, religious bigotry, the idea of living marginally in a society. So it's a lot more thoughtful than Twilight. It's a lot less about, well, it's totally about getting your jollies on with really good-looking vampires, but it's rather more thoughtful about how it does that. So, as I say, it's quite a relief to me that it exists in the same time space as Twilight, because something had to, really. So, very briefly, because we're out of time again, Vampire Diaries is kind of a cross between. This is also teen television, based, as I said earlier, in the 1992 series of books by L.J. Smith. The books are rather terrible. The series is much better. Like Buffy, it has a high school focus. Eleanor is the main character. She is at school in... That's Eleanor. It's also very... I'm interested in the poster here because it's almost as sexually posed as that one, which is just ridiculous. So Eleanor is a schoolgirl in Mystic Falls, which is a small-town America again. Vampires in small-town America seem to be a thing. Stefan is a new boy at the school. He turns out to be a vampire. He's trying to blend in and be a vampire at school. Vampires in Vampire Diaries don't have to deal with the sunlight thing because nice witches can make them rings, which protects them from the effects of sunlight. So they all wander around in sunlight at all times, pretending to be normal. Once again, it's a love triangle, as you can see in the end of the poster. Stefan's the good guy vampire, trying to be a human and blend in. Damon, his brother, is a psychopath, a very beautiful psychopath, but a complete psychopath. They're both in love with Elena, and it's one of the series that is most interesting, in particularly given that it's a teen drama. Despite its focus on small-town America, high school experience, and, you know, if you're a vampire, you have superhuman strength, you still can't try it for the football team because it'll just be too obvious that you can leap the field in a single bound. But at the same time, it's very embedded in history, and particularly American colonial history. So the sense of Mystic Falls as a community with a past that goes back several hundred years, and therefore as a community built on effectively generations of secrets, is very interesting. It infuses the quite often very soapy and not particularly meaningful high school drama of who's bitten who next and who's become a vampire and who's dead and oh god he's a werewolf and etc 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 with this quite interesting layer of thoughtfulness and placing of that essentially teen experience into a much broader context that doesn't just go out into the town, it goes back into the town's past. So it has bucket loads of teen angst. It's full of werewolves and witches and school friends becoming vampires. And like the Buffy, although I think with less sophistication, it overlays the vampire onto a small town high school experience specifically to explore teen concerns and angst on another level. It uses, not quite as well as Buffy did, but still quite powerfully, those symbols to talk about the kinds of issues that teenagers face. It has a very huge following. It's now going into its, what, third, fourth season? I've lost track. I'm not up to date with Vampire Diaries. So it's very much a female, it's fairly female teen following. I think there's enough there to keep a broader demographic interested. But its appeal is almost identical to the appeal of a normal, sort of realistic high school show. These are good-looking guys, and a vampire element adds a spice of danger, but in a sense the appeal is almost identical to the realistic version. So those three texts, Vampire Diaries, Twilight, True Blood, are kind of where our moment is at with vampires. It's not the only moment. I mean, there's other things happening. They're the two main series that I've chosen to talk about because I think their play, particularly with the idea of beauty and immortality, is so interesting. Off on the side, you are getting other things happening. The other text that I haven't dealt with in any detail, but that I thoroughly recommend, is the Swedish film Let the Right One In, which deals with a female vampire who's a child in a much, much more Murnau-esque, Herzog-esque, vulnerable vampire. It deals with the grottiness of being a vampire. Once you've drunk everybody's blood, what do you do with the body? It's sordid. The vampire's life in that story is sordid. But it's a very beautifully made film. I recommend the Swedish version rather than the American one. Very beautifully filmed with an awful lot of blood on snow, which always works visually. So vampires as a thoughtful trope, as a way of deconstructing our time and place and our concerns and angst and all the rest of it, is still here. And actually every text that I've referred to in this lecture does it to a greater or lesser extent. The problem, I think, is that it mostly is to a lesser extent, although there may be elements of interest in history, deconstruction of marginality, whatever, what being a teenager is in terms of coming to terms with sexuality. At the same time, the other thing that happens is that the vampire film and TV series particularly becomes very much mainstreamed in the sense that it becomes the purview of large corporate interests who will moderate what goes into it because it needs to make money. So there is this almost inevitable drift in the vampire series or the vampire film towards the kinds of slightly superficial ideas that are very much in tune with where modern media is at, because that is safe and comfortable, and people will continue to buy it, and therefore they will be able to afford to continue to make it. because it costs an awful lot. Particularly when you get the kind of following that you do around some of these actors and the kinds of salaries that they are able to command for continuing to appear in these series. It's a very nasty sort of arms race in a financial sort of way. So overall, I think we've come a very long way from the folkloric vampire of the pre-19th century. We've come a very long way even from Polidori or Stoker's monstrous aristocrat. You can see over 2.5 centuries how vampires have morphed. They've shifted, they've adapted. They've adapted not just to new narratives and new media, but they have adapted to their times in a particularly powerful way. They are a very, very, very multivalent and interesting symbol that acts as a vehicle for our preoccupations, our fears, our desires, our anxieties. There's enough going on in that symbol, there's enough tension and layering and what have you, that it has this capacity to change. The elements that are in there, simply new bits of them are emphasized and other bits drop out of sight. So the 21st century is interesting because of the way in which vampires have become mainstreamed. They are no longer just a horror motif, they become another storytelling tool inserted into other genres and modes and used to tell stories in the way that we've always told stories, but used, I think, often very powerfully. And because of that multivalence of the image, they have that capacity to allow us to make them into the thing we want and the thing we need. And I personally am very, very deeply worried by the idea that we might possibly need Edward in any way whatsoever. But as I say, we get the vampires we deserve. We get the vampires that our time asks for. If we didn't consume them as greedily as we do, and I use the metaphor advisedly, they wouldn't become what they are. So it's always fascinating to me that you can't see a vampire in the mirror. A vampire casts no reflection. A vampire is a reflection. That's why it doesn't cast one. It has no reflection because if it did, that would get in the way of the fact that actually what its reflection is us. The vampires we deserve. I hope this has made sense. I'm going to stop there so we've got some time for questions. Thank you.